give me a message and said there was no microphone attached.
She wasn't making contact. Okay, hi. Welcome. Can you hear me? Yes? In the back? You can. Yes? I don't know. Somebody raise a hand if you can hear me. You can hear me. Okay. The heck with the rest of them. Right. Thank you. Okay. We'll try that. Welcome to the very last day of summer. Tomorrow is fall. You wake up in the morning, the leaves will be beautiful, and then the next day they'll fall off, and it'll be 20 degrees. Maybe. Maybe not. Questions? Yes. Thank you. I figured if I seemed to be saying something, somebody would figure out that they couldn't hear me. All right, let's try that. Does that work better? Can you hear me now? Yes? Okay. Let me go up one more. Blow you out of the water here. There we go. Okay, I put that one back up just to remind you. I understand that on Monday the microphone was cutting in and out again. Was that terribly distracting? Yes? Okay. I don't know what to do about it. I've done everything I can this time, except that I am now experimenting. Now, this is part of my experimenting. It seemed to me that I was louder when I was over here, and that it might be cutting out when I was over here. So I had this hypothesis that there's something between the transmitter and wherever the receiver is, but that doesn't seem to be happening today. Therefore, I'm going to go back to hypothesis B, which is that the battery was dying. And now that I have a very, very brand new strong battery in it today, it'll be fine. So that's what they told me over at Media. It's very simple, just always put a new battery in. So I'm all charged up. Here we go. Questions? Other questions? Am I loud enough now? Thank you. No questions. That was an invitation. Invitation. Okay, I'll just speed on through. That was just a reminder. I want to talk more about motor development, and I wanted to call your attention to page 141 in the text. The description there is important, and it describes the viewpoints developed over a lifetime of studying infants and motor development by Esther Talen. And I've already had my moment of silence. She died this summer. And so we don't get the benefit of her work anymore. But she was one of the most important researchers and theorists about how infants develop, not just motorically, but in other ways. And one of the essences of her views is reflected in these two statements that are given in Papalia in the text. Infant and environment form an interconnected system. And by that, what she meant was that you cannot study infant development without taking into account the environment that the infant is in, that the development of the infant in many areas, but most importantly for her, motorically, the development is dependent on what opportunities and constraints and encouragement are provided by the physical environment as well as the social environment that the infant is in. And she forced us, all of us who studied her work, she forced us to think about the skills, the reflexes, the beginning tendencies that infants bring into the world with them, and how those are tuned to an expectable environment which then shapes them by its details. Motor development is a continuous process, she said, of interaction between the baby and the environment. So if you look at a text that gives you milestones for motor development and says the kid will sit up at 6 months and walk at 12 months or 14 and run at 18, roll over at 3 or 4, whatever those milestones are. Before Esther Talen's work, the general interpretation of those milestones was if the baby is physically normal and not being abused, that's all it takes. If it's physically normal and not being abused, it will do those things. And what the milestones give you is the average for the normal baby. What Esther Talen's work did was help us understand the fact that the baby isn't going to develop much of anything on schedule unless you look at the opportunities, the encouragement, and the constraints that are present in the environment. Not just once, but every day. And she did meticulous studies of infants day to day to day over the first 2 or 3 years of their lives and looked at the way the body that the baby brings with it is used by the baby as it acts in the environment and adapts to the opportunities and the constraints in that environment. And she picked up on work that had been done years earlier by another woman named Myrtle McGraw, who helped us understand that there's a wide variability in what normal infants do. And that variability has several sources. One is the particular body that the infant brings with it, because bodies are not all the same, and the opportunities and constraints provided by the particular environment that the baby is in. Esther Talen helped us understand that what you have is a system, the infant and the environment, that works together, and that motor development, as many other systems in the body and in the development now appear to be, organizes itself. It doesn't take an adult or caregivers to do that organizing. The system has evolved to develop in conjunction with the environment that it's in to create a system of movement, in the case of motor development, that is more or less skilled, more or less complex. And the differences among babies as they develop are due both to the particular baby and its temperament and the kind of body that it has, and the environment that either constrains or encourages particular kinds of development. So for Esther Talen, it wasn't surprising that some babies don't crawl. And it wasn't surprising that some babies don't crawl on their knees. And it wasn't surprising that some babies stand up and walk long before other babies do. Her interest was in how you account for that in a particular baby. Development of motor skills has multiple causes. It's not just maturation of the body or brain. So it's not just the baby is sitting there waiting till its body and brain get able. Practice, exercise, activity are going to make the body able within limits. Babies have different motivation. They really are lumps. The kids who are born who would prefer to sit in front of the television, even if they don't have one, they sit. They're not particularly active. There are other kids that you couldn't make sit if you wanted to. And those are genetic differences, probably. They're certainly built in. Babies have different physiological temperaments when they're born. The physical characteristics of the infant are important. If you want to look at differences in the timing of when babies stand up and start walking on their own, a thin, wiry baby is going to do that earlier than a baby who is particularly heavy and stocky. It's going to do that because it has less to hoist. It's easier to stand up if you're not bringing much weight up with you. The infant's position in a particular setting is important. Is it in an environment that encourages motor development? Is it in an environment that doesn't encourage the development? In fact, discourages it. Some communities wrap their kids up tightly, keep them on boards until they're a year old. Those kids don't stand up by themselves as early as kids who are held upright and bounced and encouraged and passed from person to person and encouraged to take steps every day. Those kids will have an opportunity to practice and develop the musculature that's necessary for walking. So where the child is in a particular community will help. Some of you have probably seen pictures of villages in which it's important in the community for kids to become mobile quickly and be able to go from house to house. So the community builds walking rails, or cruising rails, we call them. So kids can pull themselves up, and as soon as they can get themselves up, they can hang on and cruise from hut to hut in the village. Those kids learn to walk much faster than kids who are in communities who don't provide something for them to hang on to. Cruising is an important step in mobility. Cruising means standing up and then holding on. Being able to walk before you have the balance to walk independently. Practice, practice, practice. The more kids practice any skill, the better it gets. It really is true. Your parents told you that, your coaches told you that, your teachers told you that. Phelan tells us that. It's necessary. Movement is also necessary for the body to develop. We talked about maturation. But maturation doesn't happen without action. And let me give you sort of my classic example of that. You all have hips, right? Bones. And the pelvis is designed so that your femurs, your thigh bones, come up and fit into the sockets that develop to create your hips. When a child is born, you may have noticed that you can put it down on the floor, and I can't do this, but you can take the legs and stick them straight out at a 90-degree angle, make a 180-degree angle, and the kid doesn't protest. And some infants can take their legs and you can put them back here. Kids lying down, you put the kid's feet next to its ears. That's because it doesn't have any hip sockets. There's no joint yet. The femur has begun to form, and the pelvis has begun to form, but it's not developed yet. What's going to happen is that as you put stress on the femur and weight on the head of it by standing the baby up and having it push or giving it things to kick against while it's lying down. The weight, the resistance, the pressure on the pelvis is going to create the sockets that the head of the femur fit in. If you don't stand the baby up, if you don't put that stress, if you don't do the bouncy, bouncy baby thing, the femur and the hip socket won't form a tight joint. You end up with a loose cup for the femur to fit in. So babies that don't have the opportunity in the environment, they're not encouraged to stand up, they're not helped to stand up, they're not encouraged to stand up, for whatever reason, whether it's because they don't have feet or they don't have caregivers who put them up, they don't have that stress, develop a hip that will easily dislocate. The head of the femur will slip out. That's a particular problem. Some of you may know kids with Down syndrome. Down syndrome kids, it's a chromosomal disorder, tend to be hypotonic. They don't have much muscle strength. H-Y-P-O-T-O-N-I-C. Hypo, not enough. Tone. So their muscles aren't toned. And that continues. They continue not to have a lot of muscle strength unless they exercise a lot. So one of the difficulties for Down syndrome kids, if they're just left and not stimulated by standing them up and helping them walk and eventually getting them running and exercising, the problem for them is that they grow up to be teenagers and adults with loose hips. And their hips are easily dislocated. And over time, as adults, they develop a gait that involves not being able to stand up straight. They roll from side to side. And that makes exercise difficult, and that creates weight problems. So they have healthy appetites, but they're not burning the calories. So there's a cycle, kind of a cascade of difficulties that come because the infant has particular physical characteristics. Its muscles aren't strong. And its motivation to do things is not great because its brain doesn't process information. It doesn't see things and try to figure out how to get to them. So it doesn't practice as much. And then the body doesn't mature in ways that are going to support motor development later and may lead to other problems. Kind of a classic example of needing to have an environment that does the expectable things, which is bouncing you up and down, so that your hip bones, your joints, will form. And that leads you then to be able to move. That leads you to be able to exercise more and develop more skills. Okay. Elaborating on a couple of those points, what our motor development begins with is the reflexes and the structural possibilities of the skeleton and muscular system. So when I say that it's a self-organizing system, it's a self-organizing system that's based on having reflexes, which means the system operates in particular ways. And there are structural possibilities. And then using the activity and exercising and practice lead to differentiation of different parts. I went over some of this on Monday. Isolation or differentiation of those parts and gradual control. Then you can engage in goal-directed behavior. What you see when you're watching an infant is that it's constantly practicing. It's constantly moving the equipment that it has and trying to get to things, interact with caregivers, and it's learning and refining the things that work. So I mentioned kids who don't crawl. If you're encouraged to stand up a lot and you're working on those muscles and you have the opportunity to stand with something to lean on, it's much easier to cover distance if you're not crawling. So some kids focus on the walking and they don't perfect the crawling. Other kids don't have the opportunity to stand up a lot. They may be on slippery floors. They may not have anything to lean on because of the physical environment that they're in. So they perfect crawling. Another example I like is a little girl who was crawling. She was born in September. In fact, she was born 37 years ago tomorrow, on September 22nd. We know her well. She was born in September. She was in the house all winter. And spring came, and she was crawling moderately well in the house. And we started spending spring days outside. And most of the time in the front yard. Well, this happened to be in Pittsburgh. Front yards in Pittsburgh typically are, although they have grass, under the grass is gritty industrial crap. Metallic stuff that has come out of the air over the years. So the ground is not pleasant to kneel on. So here she was on the ground. Okay, and she wanted to do her crawling, but that was really unpleasant. So she adapted to the constraint in the environment, the constraint being, this hurts my knees. And I knew that because if I were in shorts and kneeling on the ground, it was painful. You know, the stuff would get embedded in your knees. But she wanted to cover territory. So with the creativity that almost all kids have, she adapted the system to allow her to be mobile. And the way she did that was to get her knees off the ground. And she proceeded to drop her iPod. I can't do that. I hope it still works. They're tough, aren't they? Okay. Remind me to make a note to get some kind of holster so I can stand on my head later without dropping it. They have, right, you have things you can, yeah. Okay. So what she learned to do was to get up on all fours, and she did that all summer. That was her way of locomoting, and she got really, really good at it. Looks like a daddy long legs, but that's the way she did it until she was able to get up and start to walk. No detrimental effects that we're aware of. Yeah, she just did it. Another child that I'm particularly fond of, her younger brother, was learning to walk in the winter, and he had gotten crawling down really well after a lot of work. And then he got standing up, and then one day he took off 8 steps across the kitchen. He was fine until he fell on his feet, which was okay. And then he got sick. And for about a week, he wasn't able to stand up on his own. He wasn't able to walk. And he regressed. He went way back because his own body, I started with the old overhead, the characteristics of his own body temporarily were keeping him from practicing. So he went back to crawling, but when he crawled after he'd been sick, he developed a very rapid way of calling that included being kind of half up. So he would put one foot down.
He'd get up like he was going to stand up. And then he would go. And he developed that into, I can't do it, I'm sorry, I can't demonstrate it. But he developed that into pushing off with the foot that he had put out, and with the other hand then scooting. And he developed that into what I call a lope. He actually got two limbs off the floor at the same time to cover territory very quickly.
And he did. It was very, very fast. And it was so effective that he didn't go back to trying to walk for another month. Because he'd found something that worked using the muscles that he'd developed as he was learning to stand up. But he integrated them into a completely new system. Unfortunately, before the invention of videotape. Okay. What's happening while kids are doing the practice is that they're developing the connections in the brain. And I mentioned this Monday. The number of connections is increasing, and the brain is becoming more organized into networks of cells. What that means for motor development is that what you get is action, which is being shaped by the structure of the body and the environment, and it's creating the brain connections, and the brain connections are enabling better action. And the improved or integrated action that's becoming more complex leads to more brain connections and then to more developed action. So you have this spiral going on of action creating connections, allowing for more coordinated action, that making more complex connections, so that the brain and the motor skills are cycling together with the ability to manipulate and locomote around the environment in more complex ways. Assuming that the environment allows you to do that. So, think of it this way. It's a dynamic system. That's the phrase we get from Esther Talin. When you develop a new skill, it leads to new opportunities. The new opportunities encourage more skill. The new skill, more complex skill, leads to new opportunities. And this goes on through your life. And it's an important developmental principle that when you acquire a new skill, it increases the probability of further new skills. So it's a system that builds on itself. Let me talk for a minute about the older research. I mentioned that Esther Talin built on some work by Myrtle McGraw. And that's a picture of a kid who has participated in Myrtle McGraw's research, which she actually began in the 1930s and continued into the 50s. What Myrtle McGraw did was she wanted to find out how much the environment and practice and encouragement could do to shape kids' motor skills. So she identified a group of twins middle class, basically healthy kids. And then she recruited them and recruited one of each pair into a 2 or 3 times a week activity period in her lab. And the other twin was excluded, and the other twin was simply raised as it was going to be raised by its cooperative middle-class parents. And they all grew up normal. What she did was begin with very low-level encouragement of motor skills. 20 minutes, half an hour. Gradually becoming more complex as the kid develops strength and balance and motivation. This kid, still in diapers, a little over a year old, has on his own climbed from there to there to there to there to there. There may be another one that you can't see. To there. To there. He is about 7 feet in the air, and he's retrieving something from the ceiling. That is the result of months of opportunity to climb and play a game that started with standing up to reach for something and then figuring out how to go up steps in an environment that made that safe to do. Is that kid in danger? Well, notice, that's a white skirt. There's a graduate student standing behind, ready to catch him if he falls that way. If he falls this way, I don't know. I guess the person holding the camera grabs him. Or maybe not. Maybe just records how he falls. Let's see. What Myrtle McGraw did was demonstrate very nicely for us that early experience. Oh, tell me to.
Oh. Oh, there we go.
That early experience in climbing, having balance beams, having the opportunity to roller skate, riding a tricycle, as early as the kid could possibly manage it with support, do impart an advantage in motor skills. Having those opportunities help the kids develop more complex motor skills. And what happened was that the other twins eventually learned the skills, but differently. And that was the interesting piece for her. She didn't doubt that you could help the kids develop the skills. These kids were not driven. They were just simply allowed the opportunity. And what she demonstrated was that most kids have an intrinsic motivation to adapt to their environment and become competent in getting around it and controlling their bodies. What she found was that if you looked at how they did things later, how they did them, the kids who had the early experience, even with no further intervention after they were 4, when you look at them in their 20s, the kids who had had the early enrichment experience were more graceful and skilled in doing simple everyday things than the twin who didn't have that extra experience. I saw her speak once when she was showing some of her old films, and one of them was real cute. She got these 2 twin boys who had been in her study to come to her house. She was in her 80s at that point and had retired, but she had the boys who were in their, I think they were 27 or 28, they were in mid to late 20s. She got them to strip down to their underwear, which was fun, and then she had them do things like walk a balance beam, walk backward, climb a ladder against the side of her house. And the difference between the 2 guys is startling, because the one who didn't have the early experience can do those things, although he's not too good on the balance beam. He slipped off a couple of times. And when he went up the ladder, he went up the ladder the way I do. I'm an acrophobic. Okay, so when I go up the ladder, I get beyond the second step, I am hanging on. And eventually, if I get 10 steps up, I'm beginning to get white knuckly. You know, and it's effortful. The kid who had had their early experience looks at the ladder and skips up it. 10 steps up, 10 rungs down. Just like he was born on it, like a monkey. Just, he had it all. And we don't know what they did during the years from 4 to the mid-20s. But McGraw's interpretation was that the early experience gave them different experience that then enabled them to build more competence. And the competence probably increased their confidence in motor skills and their enjoyment of them, so that when they got into activities like soccer or baseball or football or track, they were more successful, which increases your motivation. So they went farther. So the early experience opened opportunities for them, which probably increased their participation and practice and led to real significant differences by the time they were older. And that point is in the last line, which I have there. The early experiences change the nature of subsequent experience. So the kids who had the enriched experience were able to do more when they got into typical experiences. Here's another fun example of that. When did you learn to water ski? This is the Guinness Book of World Record holder of the record for earliest water skiing. This is a young man named Tarks Bonifay. 7 months and 29 days. Just shy of 8 months. What were you doing at 8 months? I wasn't water skiing. He is holding on. He's wearing a life vest. This is safe. He is using two skis. Why? His parents were performers in an aqua show. His kid grew up in the water. He's half fish. So they're taking advantage of the fact that at that period in life, 7 to 8 months, kids are learning to stand on their own, and their extensor tone is encouraging them to be rigid. And so his legs are rigid, but he's also got enough balance to keep those up, keep himself up on that. And at that point, he was unable to walk. He hadn't learned to walk yet, but he could water ski. Okay. Now, McGraw says, and Esther Thalen would agree, that having that early experience probably changed the nature of his later experience. So, a few years ago, I happened to be reading Time magazine, and there was this neat article about this 15-year-old who had just won the World Wakeboarding Championship. It's Parks Bonifay. So from being the youngest water skier, he went to being one of the world's very best water skiers. But he didn't start wakeboarding until he was 12. And so within 3 years, he had completely mastered that skill. And if you recall, there was a water skiing and wakeboarding championship in August in Vermont. The New England Championships, or maybe it was national, I don't know, but I watched very carefully to see if one of the people skiing was Parks Bonifay, who would now be 23. So we can probably guess that he's still comfortable in the water. and on the skis. Okay. I was editing. Sorry. Don't worry about me. Okay. By the time you're 5 or 6, you've got most of the basic motor skills and have practiced them to the degree that you're encouraged to. And at that point, we put you in sports programs, if we haven't already before. And the kids who have had the early experience do better. And we say they're more talented. And sometimes we say that they have a gift for soccer or whatever it is. But the bottom line lesson, the take-home lesson from McGraw's work and Phelan's, is that if you want to create a kid who's a super soccer player, you want to think about the skills that go into soccer and encourage those early. Okay? Because it's going to create opportunities for the kid to practice. It's going to create the motivation. It helps if you as a parent also enjoy soccer, so you'll do it with the kid. So one of the best soccer players I know who came through the Vermont system had a father who played soccer. His mother liked to play soccer. The kid's baby gift from his grandmother was a soccer ball. So he was born. So here's this cute little boy in his crib. Other people get teddy bears, bunny rabbits. He had those. But he also had a soccer ball. And he carried the soccer ball around. He slept with the soccer ball. When he learned to walk, he learned to kick, to push the soccer ball. When he learned to run, he learned to propel a soccer ball. And when he got really good balance, he learned to kick it, to lift it, to throw it, to catch it, to bounce it. They did stop at heading it. It's not good for babies to head soccer balls. Not good. But he had the opportunity and the encouragement to practice the skill, so by the time he got into a youth soccer league at 6, he was clearly way ahead of every other kid. So his experience was, all through college, being the star, because he had the skills very early and was able to move beyond that and integrate them so that he was extremely competent at it. He had the physical build for it. He had the motivation for it. It created his social life. And he did lots of other things too. Soccer wasn't the only thing he did. It just was the thing that he was outstanding at. The East Germans and the Russians have known that for generations. If you're going to have gold medal winners in the Olympics, you recruit the kids in infancy and you start them in programs. And by the time they're 5 or 6, you have them in special schools and you give them the opportunity to practice and be motivated all the way. Okay. Questions about any of that? I haven't given you much chance. Okay, you have to email them to me. As we get older, what happens to physical development and growth? The body slows down in its development, continues to grow. And one of the neat things about the period from 5 or 6 on up to puberty is that the body proportions don't change very much. If you look at 5 or 6 year olds and look at kids who are 10 and haven't started puberty yet, you see that the proportions of the body are very similar. And what that means is that kids have a long period of time when their skills are relatively constant, but they can hone them. They can become more skilled. They can integrate them. that they're not in the position of having to adapt to major changes in their body. When you learn to walk as a toddler, you have to adapt to major changes. And the body is changing rapidly during toddlerhood and infancy. So you're constantly dealing with this new apparatus. It's constantly changing. But in middle childhood, not much is going on. Another characteristic of development through middle childhood is that boys and girls are essentially the same except for one little detail on the other side of the body from the tail. So boys and girls have very little difference in the way they are built. Little difference in weight, little difference in proportions, and almost no difference in skills, strength, coordination, any of that. Assuming that they've had the same experience. And that's an important assumption. If they've had the same experience. If the little boys are encouraged to run and jump and develop balance and integrate their motor skills, they will do that. If the little girls are discouraged from doing that, they won't, and then they will be different. But if they have the same opportunities and encouragement, they will develop essentially to the same level, given motivation, because there are no major differences in the body. Then comes, you remember this, puberty, right? You all remember puberty fondly. It was your favorite period of development. Just think for a minute about puberty. Not too hard. Don't want to depress you. What do you remember about puberty? Let's write down the first couple of things that come to mind about puberty. Just jot them down. What do you remember?
Hormones, raging.
Raging hormones. Those are good. What'd you write?
What did I write?
Yeah.
Just write what you remember.
Oh, okay. You didn't write down things you remember. What do you remember?
Getting hairy.
Hairy. Hair. Okay. Androgen effects.
Body growth.
Body growth. In strange places. Right?
Period.
Period. Menstruation. That's the end of puberty. First menstruation is the end of puberty.
Voice change.
That's because your vocal cords get longer. Remember the period of time while it was changing? Well, isn't that fun? Just having a squeak? Yeah. And then having people call on the telephone and mistaking you for your mother? That could be useful at times. They didn't mistake me for my mother. They mistook me for my father or my big brother.
Changing relationships.
You want to elaborate? Your parents became...
Parents and peers.
Your parents became overprotective. Yep. Okay. That's typical. Your peers, what did they do? They started liking boys, but you didn't. That's okay. Boys, the other sex or the same sex, whichever your proclivities are, become interesting. And you start snapping girls' bras. Right? You start checking to see if they're wearing a bra. You start making jokes about athletic supporters. Pups, the hockey players, all those things. Okay, hair on the face, other places. Remember being self-conscious? Yeah. You liked it when people looked at you and commented on how you were growing? Right? Especially people about 5 years older than you who looked at you admiringly and said, "Ooh, you're getting big." Yeah. That was fun, right? You remember zits? Yeah. Oily skin. Hair that you didn't like. At least you had it. Actually, most of you, while you were gaining hair on parts of your body, you were also losing hair. And one of the things that happens as you begin to go through puberty is that your hairline recedes for males and females. So if you look at pictures of yourself before puberty, you'll see that your hairline typically goes back a little bit. For some people, that's a good thing because they were worried about not having foreheads. And so having something there to get shiny and have zits on is encouraging. For others of us who already had high foreheads, it started at puberty and then just kept right on going. Just going. It went. It's gone. This is one of my favorite little kids looked at me when I was about as tall as I am now at 30. And he looked at me and said, "Gee, your hair got off." That was a nice way to put it. It just, you know, sort of, okay, I don't want to be on this head anymore. So you remember puberty fondly. Erections? Remember those. Yeah. Your own and other people's. Curiosity about them. And all those sorts of things. Okay, some reminder. These are people. One's a boy, one's a girl. And if we're going to understand puberty, which is our goal in the next 20 minutes, plus a little bit of next Monday, we need to know about the hypothalamus, which is a small area of the brain, the pituitary, which is another area of the brain right next to it, the thyroid, which is in your neck area, the adrenal cortices, I mentioned those the other day, these are kidneys, and the adrenal cortices look like lima beans, kind of stapled to the top of the kidneys, ovaries, and testes. And in that picture, this is not a prepubescent pair of people, because there are breasts and the genitalia on the male appear to be relatively well developed. So they are postpubescent people. Puberty comes along normally comes along anytime between 7 or so to 16 or 17. And it begins, and when it begins, we call that the onset. So what happens at the beginning of puberty is that you begin to grow more rapidly than you have been growing. And I'll show you a graph of that. The text has one as well. So what happens is that you begin a growth spurt. And what determines when that happens is your weight. That's the best predictor, your weight. And that suggests that puberty is fundamentally under metabolic control. The hypothalamus is monitoring your metabolism, how many calories you need, what kinds of changes need to happen in your endocrine system to keep your body well nourished and functioning well. The hypothalamus is monitoring a whole bunch of chemical factors in the body. And when you reach the threshold weight, you begin to grow more rapidly. So one of the consequences of puberty is that you become bigger And metabolically, that means more efficient. We don't really know why the body decides at a particular point to become more efficient, but bigger bodies require fewer calories per kilogram because they don't lose heat as quickly. Little bodies, like shrews, have to eat their weight in insects every day. You can't eat your weight in insects or anything else every day, and you don't need to because you don't metabolize that quickly because you maintain your heat, you retain your heat. So one of the differences among us is that we experience the onset of puberty at different times. Some of us literally begin at 7, have breast buds at 8, menstruate at 10, have babies at 12. That's perfectly normal. Well, not socially, but it's physiologically perfectly normal. The average onset in our society is about 9 or 10, and the average beginning of menstruation is about 12 for girls. But you can also start the whole process at 13 or 14 and menstruate for the first time at 16 or 17 and be perfectly normal. And that variability is primarily genetic. The best predictor of when you're going to start, as well as how fast it's going to happen, is your parent of the same sex's pattern. So if you think about your own and have a child of the same sex, the best prediction you can make is that your child will go through puberty at about the same time you did, maybe a little bit earlier, and in about the same way you did. And that works pretty well. And that suggests that it's primarily genetic, as are most of the other physiological processes in the body. Okay. Timing, that's when it starts, and rate are separate. And so some of those kids who start at 7 or 8 go through it very quickly, and others go through it very slowly. And there's not much connection between the onset and the rate, the timing and the rate. So some of us go through it extremely quickly. You can go from breast buds to menarche in 6 months. That's very fast. You can also go from breast buds to menarche in 6 years. And some of you probably did. And that, too, is primarily genetically determined. You can have a different pattern, have two different patterns in the same family. And again, I always like to talk about myself because we have two patterns in the family. So my father, looking at his two sons, could have predicted the pattern from his own. He developed early. He developed quickly. He ended up 6'1". He was 6'1" about the time he was a freshman in high school. That was his height. And he had two sons. The older son, my brother, my big brother, went through puberty in sixth grade. And I mean went through it. All of it. From the beginning, at the middle of sixth grade to into seventh grade, but in the seventh grade he reached his ultimate height, which was 6 feet. He grew so quickly during that period of time that he spent a lot of time in bed. His body was simply exhausted. He grew about 7.5 inches in the course of less than a year. And his joints hurt, and that's fairly common. The faster you go through puberty, the more difficulty you have with it. That was it. So in eighth grade, he was the star center on the basketball team because he was the tallest kid in the eighth grade. And those of you who play basketball know that some centers play defense and some play offense, and the best ones play both. Taylor Coppinger, both. You know, so they get rebounds and offensive shots. My brother could pick one end of the court to play on, but he couldn't get to the other end. One of the consequences of going through puberty extremely quickly is clumsiness. Remember, middle childhood, the period of growth is slow, the body proportions don't change much, you have time to adapt to the changes. If you go through puberty very quickly, the body is changing so quickly that you can't keep up with it. So the joy of being a little brother was watching my big brother, A, be in bed aching because his joints hurt, and then being able to provoke him, as little brothers are supposed to do, in ways that would get him to try to chase me. And chase was a game that I began to win because I was little and fast, and he would turn and fall on his face. On the basketball court, he would grab a rebound, come down, start to dribble, fall on his face. He would shoot, turn around, try to chase the ball down to the other end, fall on his face. He spent more time on the basketball court floor than playing basketball. Even later in life, he never really got it together. He was never comfortable in his body. And one of the advantages that I had was that I grew slowly and therefore turned out to be graceful and skilled and competent in everything. And that was an advantage because I was considerably smaller. I made it to 5'10". My pattern was entirely different. What my brother and I did, our favorite sport to play together was tennis. And I took advantage of his inability to change directions quickly, so I would get him headed to one side of the court. He would volley back, return, and then I would go to the other side, and he could never make more than two turns. So I just alternated. I could stand in the same spot, and he would eventually miss, fall on his face. It was really cruel. It was payback. For years, it was payback. I do want to, in all fairness to him, point out that he lettered in a sport in college. He finally found a sport that allowed him to be tight and unable to change directions. And that was fencing. Fencing is very cool. You go forward, back. And in the movies, you go all over the set. But in competitive fencing, it's forward, back, and it helps to be kind of tight. I guess. I've never tried it. I don't like pointy things coming at me. It's not my skill. So, little brother came along, and got through sixth grade without much in the way of change, and then got through seventh grade without much in the way of change. So here's the brother who was 6 feet, and the brother who was less than 5 feet at the same age. 15 inch difference if you put us on the same time scale. Which one gets taken to the doctor because his growth is abnormal? One of the things that happens in families is that firstborns set the standard, the expectation. Secondborns and thirdborns who don't match are obviously defective in some way. They are the ones with the problem. Nobody ever said that my brother's growth was abnormal. Although if you look at it, in fact it was, and it was debilitating for him while he was going through it. So I finally began puberty sometime in eighth grade and had a really nice, easy time. Growth spurt was not big. I was 5'2 by the time I got into high school. No, 5'1, I cheated. 5'1 going into high school. 5'8 or so when I graduated from high school. 5'10 when I graduated from college. I'm back to about 5'9. I try to stand up straight. That's what happens in later life. You begin to lose that. So we had very different patterns. How does that fit with the genetics? I'm adopted? No. How it fits with the genetics is that my favorite uncle and I look very much alike, but the two brothers looked alike too. All three of the brothers in my father's family looked alike. But there were clearly two growth patterns, two pivotal growth patterns in that family. And my father and his older brother had the same one that my brother had, and the uncle, the younger, and I had the same growth pattern. And I had one son, and his growth pattern is exactly like mine. So the firstborn was at the 95th percentile in height and weight all the way from infancy on. The younger was at the 5th percentile in height and weight. 7th, 8th, you know, maybe 10th one year, all the way through. So there's a genetic pool that has two different patterns. Development is not competitive. And that's the lesson that I'd like you to take home about the genetic determination of onset and weight. Development is not competitive, and yet, in many families, it's treated as a competitive sport. In many peer group settings, it's treated as a competitive sport. Parents compete to have the kid who's biggest, fastest, earliest, most whatever. Kids pick that up, and they pick it up particularly in middle school, and they pick it up particularly if they're not the biggest or earliest, or if they're not going through the changes that other kids are going through. And they have to adapt to that. It helps if people around them explain that, hey, it's your genes. Don't worry about it. You'll get there. All of us eventually get through puberty. And all of us eventually become grown-ups and adults, with very few exceptions. And it doesn't particularly matter biologically whether you do that early or later. Socially, being early is a mixed blessing. And the text describes some of the positives and negatives. Earlier maturers have more difficulty with puberty. So the earlier you go through it, the harder it is for you. The faster you go through it, the harder it is, physically and psychologically. Early maturing, both boys and girls, have more anxiety, have more temper tantrums, have more conflict with their parents, feel worse about themselves. Everybody hates themselves when they're going through puberty. But if you're very early, you hate yourself more because you don't know what's going on. You may be biologically way ahead of your cognitive and social skills. That's a danger. Early maturing kids are more likely to get involved in grown-up activities that they're not ready for, more likely than kids who are average or late going through puberty. So the earliest maturing kids are more likely to be involved in drugs, alcohol, smoking, sex, more likely to get pregnant during adolescence, all of those things that come about because the peer group is responding to you differently because you've gone through puberty. Your whole social world changes. And if you're not ready for those changes, if you're not ready at 10 to be hit on by 17-year-olds, if you're not ready at 10 or 11 to be expected to behave in a mature fashion, if you don't know how to do that, then you're likely to be more swayed by peer pressure. And early maturing kids are more susceptible to peer pressure as they go through puberty. Okay. Pattern. The pattern differs for a very simple reason. There are two primary classes of hormones that are raging, but they don't rage at the same time as you go through puberty. And sometimes they're raging at the same time, I'm going to give you a handout that describes the endocrinology of puberty, and we'll go over this on Monday, so be sure to bring it back. Don't memorize it, and it won't be on the exam in this fashion. So don't worry about that. But what happens is that as you're going through puberty, you begin to increase what we call male hormones, but both sexes have them, from those adrenal cortices, the little lima beans on the kidneys. You also begin to secrete female hormones, estrogenic substances, also from the adrenal cortices. And that's when the beginning of the secondary sex characteristics takes place. The androgen or male hormones and the estrogenic or female hormones have different consequences. And what happens to you, the sequence of that pattern of changes that you go through, depends on how much of each of those classes of hormones you're producing and how your body is responding to them. So some people begin to get the feminizing changes, both male and female, first, and then the androgenizing changes. So some of us get breast buds, including males, and subcutaneous fat, those are female kinds of characteristics, before we get hairy. And others of us get hairy before we develop any of the estrogenic characteristics. And we'll go over that in considerable detail on Monday.